Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the NOLA Drink Show, friends. I do appreciate it. As always, happy to have you here. And I'm hoping everybody out there is as safe, well, and healthy as they possibly can be. And I also hope that everybody out there is playing their part the way we need to all play it to get us through to the other side as soon as possible. It is incumbent upon all of us to be good citizens, good neighbors, good family members, good friends to everyone. This all falls on all of us. Hopefully, if we continue to do what we're supposed to do, we'll start to see ourselves on the other side of this sooner than later. Listen to the sound officials. Listen to the science. There's a lot of crackpots out there. I do understand that people are getting restless. It's a tough situation. It's a very tough situation. The implications of this are incredibly serious and in many cases incredibly grave, not just talking about the threat to health and life, but talking about the threat to the economy and so on and so forth. I do understand all of that. But the last thing in the world that we need is to get a little bit too enthusiastic, get right back out there, start doing what we normally used to do, and have this all blow up again. It could just be that much worse than it was the first time around. We're all still kind of feeling our way as we go. The science is showing us a lot of stuff. Science is science. Science is fact. Now, are we still working on science? Absolutely. But that's the best information that we have out there. Don't listen to the crackpot officials that don't know what the hell they're talking about. Stay safe, play your part, do what you're supposed to do, and we'll get ourselves through to the other side as soon as we can. Friends, got a really good show coming up for you. Been excited to do this one for a good amount of time. We're going to be talking about the wines of Georgia. Now, as I sit here in Louisiana, we're talking about the country of Georgia, of course, over there on the east coast of the Black Sea. Now, to the best of my recollection, I'm not sure that I've ever had any wines from Georgia before. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. They've only been at it for about 8,000 years. Don't know where the hell I've been, but hey, get to rectify it here. When we taped the interview just the other day, tasted through some really, really lovely wines. And I'll be honest, rarely am I surprised about things when I taste stuff in these situations. And I found myself pleasantly surprised by pretty much everything I tasted. It's really amazing stuff, really interesting, really unique wines. And we chat with Noel Brockett, who is the director of sales and operations for Georgian Wine House, a very fine leading importer of Georgian wines here into the United States. Great guy, really fun guest, super knowledgeable about the wines, of course, as you can imagine, but he's also very immersed and familiar with the culture. He spent a lot of time out there, married a local woman, speaks the language. So really a great guy who provides a great amount of context, not only just about the wine, the winemaking, how the wines taste, so on and so forth, but the historical and cultural context of 8 millennia of winemaking in Georgia. We talk a lot about the history. We talk a lot about current winemaking trends and examples, how the history, the long-standing history, as we've noted, informs winemaking today, and just the type of stuff that we're seeing come out of there. It's really the cradle of winemaking on our planet. So it's a great place to explore, and some of these wines are just absolutely tasty, super price point friendly, surprisingly so on a lot of levels. And if you're listening on the radio, I do encourage you to go to our website, go to noladrinks.com, and get the podcast, because we're going to continue the interview there, and we talk a lot more about stuff. And you'll also see on the website pictures of the wines and some really cool background information. Some of the spelling is a little difficult, I'll be honest with you, and the pronunciation. So you'll see it all there written out for you. But friends, what we're going to do here is we're going to take a little break on the NOLA Drink Show, and then we're going to bounce right back to our featured interview with Noel Brockett talking about wines of Georgia. Come on back. Since 42.
Iron tub ice down full of Falstaff brew. Black head of sun, Bobby Charles cold blue. Catholic church bells toll the Louisiana blues. Oyster rake scraping down Grand Isle Way.
Drinking wine for the old man. Drinking wine for the old man.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening to the NOLA Drink Show. Friends, this week, as always, really excited to bring you the show. Been looking forward to it and working on it for a little while. We're going to be talking about the wines of Georgia, the country, of course. And I'm pleased to be joined by my guest, Noel Brockett, who is the Director of Operations and Sales for Georgian Wine House. Noel, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian. Excited to do it.
Absolutely. And I mentioned that you were the Director of Operations and Sales for Georgia Wine House, which is an importer, and we'll get to that in a bit. But I do like in your bio that as opposed to just Director of Operations and Sales, you're also the resident evangelist and problem solver at Georgia Wine House. I think that's great, man.
That's the nature of small business as well.
Yeah, you and I were just talking about that before we went on the air in a different way in the world of small business these days. But you guys are an importer that works with obviously various wine producers in the country of Georgia. And we mentioned this at the top of the show, but a long millennia-old history of winemaking. And I figured that would be a really cool place to start if we can kind of give people the nutshell. It's hard to squeeze 8,000 years of winemaking into a 12-minute segment, but I figure we can give people the overview.
Yeah, absolutely. Georgia, the country, obviously, is. I think it's always helpful to position it on the map and understand, because that's the historical context is going to give you the understanding of when we say 8,000 years, you know, of winemaking. Most people are pretty shocked. But then if you look at the map and see where Georgia is, you know, Georgia is in what's called the Caucasus, which is named after the mountains, the mountain regions that run through Georgia. And Georgia is this small place between the Black and Caspian Sea. So if you go from Istanbul, if you can imagine that on your map, and go directly right or due east, you're going to hit Georgia. And why that's important is that it's a place that's locked at the top, at the northern border by mountains. It also has 13 distinct mountain ranges that run through it. And just about 700 or 500 kilometers below, you have, you know, what is modern day Iran. But of course, you have what most people can understand from their world civilization classes as some of the oldest, you know, civilizations, which is Mesopotamia, and Israel. So, that's the context. And the main interesting point about that is that Georgia, you know, this one way is along the Silk Road is the way that connected Europe and Asia. So a lot of people refer to it as Eurasia. Some people call it Europe. Some people call it Asia, the Near East. We'd like to call it Europe, you know, for political reasons now in Georgia. But the real truth is that it's this huge melting pot of cultures. And it's been that way ever since, even prior to civilization. So when we talk about that 8,000 years of winemaking tradition, is that literally what we're talking about is archaeological but multidisciplinary work that's been done. There's this unprecedented paper that came out in the 2017 where I think there's like 30 different disciplines that contribute to it that show both archaeologically and through history as well through pottery and all different sorts of stuff. I mean, new amazing testing that they can do, that what they've found is places that have been consistently inhabited in Georgia throughout over 8,000 years. And what they found was large fragments of large clay jars that were buried underneath the ground, which they were able to test. It had this very particular acid that is unique just to grape, so that they knew that for sure wine was being fermented and made there. At least 8,000 years ago. Of course, if you're discovering a full-fledged wine cellar 8,000 years ago, it's likely that it happened much earlier.
Right.
But, you know, and some people want to argue, okay, is it Georgia, is it somewhere else? But what really strikes you when you discover Georgia and Georgian wine is that if you go there today, you see that wine is the lifeblood of Georgian society. It's in all of its rituals. It's in all of this. It's like Italy on anybody's travels there. It's wine is the essential drink. And it's been, and if you go down through the history, it's not that somebody was making wine 8,000 years ago, but that rather this amazing birth of wine that happened 8,000 years ago has lived and been preserved in living traditions in Georgia ever since.
Yeah.
So it's this amazing place.
I think, and it's really, it's, thank you for kind of putting it into context. I think, and to frame it even further, there's as an interesting sort of fun fact, I was reading somewhere that going, you know, way back when we're talking about the time of Assyria and the Assyrian kings who would demand tribute from the places that they had conquered, usually in the form of gold, there was an exception. And in that part of the world, tributes could be paid in wine. So that would tell you about the elevated status, the breadth, I would assume, of wine production, and just kind of, you know, talking about it being a sophisticated situation way back then.
Yeah, and I mean, just to jump in there is to say that wine held a very different place in society 8,000 years ago. It was just like that. It was almost equal to gold. Why was that? It was a part of spiritual life. Was a very different thing. It was a very real, tangible thing that existed at that time. And wine was literally considered, you know, like anything that changed your brain a little bit, as something as sacred. And obviously, we see that that's true today, even in all of the sort of religions, obviously in Christianity, which is a big thing in Georgia, you know, it's still considered this sort of mystical thing. And in Georgia, one of the things that I loved from this paper that came out in 2017 was this really amazing research that was done on pottery, which it discovered a lot of the, you know, history was that there's this one group, this proto-Georgian tribe that lived in this area that developed this very unique pottery with this striking contrast of black and red. And what did they create this pottery for? It was the sacred vessels of how to drink wine. So it was these pitchers, it was these bowls, and you can literally follow the people who knew how to drink this, you know, amazing product. You can follow their pottery as it spreads out south to Mesopotamia and then goes out to the rest of the Western world through archaeological digs, because it's so unique and distinct. And that's just a great metaphor for Georgians, is that they discovered this amazing thing and they created all sorts of rituals, all sorts of things about it, and taught the world, you know, that this is a product or something that's maybe closer to the divine than, you know, just water. But at that time too, you know, it was healthier than water as well, because a lot of water wasn't potable. So it was, right. It was a whole different world back then in terms of wine. But at the same time, it's that spirit and that tradition and that love of wine and sort of sacred nature is the lifeblood of Georgia still today.
Awesome. Very cool. You know, and I want to ask you this, but well, I'm going to ask you a question about linguistics there. But let's tell people, because we're as we usually do on the show, and we do stuff like this, we're weaving in a little tasting as we go. And so tell us a little bit about the first wine. It's an amber wine, which maybe people would know that the term orange wine, pretty similar idea, I think. And can you tell us a little bit about the wine, the Tevza, that we're tasting here?
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. So it's important. So we're tasting the Tevza and don't worry, there's not going to be a test at the end.
This will all be in the show notes on the web, Noel, so people can see it.
Good. And that's because, you know, Georgian is a unique language. It's one of the, what they call the 13 original alphabets, which is this, basically these alphabets that linguists don't know what to do with, so they shove them over to the side. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really ancient language, and so we have all of these different grape varieties with strange names. But the Tevza, it's simple to remember. Tevza means fish. It's named after Goga Tevzadze, who's the winemaker. And Tevzadze means fisherman's son. And so as we have on this wine, which I really love about it, is that we have an anagram that on the label, which kind of describes what this wine is. It's from Kartli, which is a very specific region in Georgia. It's obviously a Georgian wine. The Kvevri wine, which we'll get more into as well, which is wines that are made in large clay jars. And it's a little bit crazy because it's not your normal wine, and that's because it's amber. And it's what we mean by amber or orange wine is white wines that are made similar to how red wines are, where they add the skins back in to pull out color and tannin and structure. And so the first wine that we're doing is from Gorli Mutswane, which means the green grape from the region of Gori, which is where Boga is very close to. And, you know, we talk about Georgia being the birthplace of wine, but there's these all these grapevines and all these grape varieties that were lost in sort of, especially in the last 100 years during the Soviet era. And Gorli Mutswane is one that's the lifeblood of this region, as I keep saying that, but it's from Kartli. And it's what's interesting about Tevza is that this is a person who was into winemaking, is a professional winemaker, but left winemaking and went to distilling. He makes amazing fruit brandies in Georgia. And we were always pushing him, saying, you know, Kartli is the second largest region in Georgia. We need to, you know, there's only one person being imported from this area. We need more wines from this area. You're a winemaker. Come on, you need to get on it. So finally, he, you know, got some Cuvier's back and started making tiny amounts of wine. So this was his first vintage in a long time. It's the 2018. And he made about 1,200 liters. So that's like about 1,500 bottles. Mm-hmm. So it's tiny productions in Georgia from this rare grape. And it's been aged on the skins. What's fun about amber wines is that, you know, they look this different color, but it all depends on what you do it with the skin. So you can do longer macerations. Typically in certain regions, you're aging the skins on the wine as long as 6 months. Mm-hmm. This is in between. It's about 3 or 4 months. And it's really kind of an experiment, because a lot of times this wine is not always made with such in-depth skin contact. So to look at it, you know, in the glass is this sort of darker amber in this particular one. And when you smell amber wines, they're really distinct from what most people, you know as white wine. You know, what most people know as white wine is a modern invention in general, once you have refrigeration. But this is, instead of getting those fresh, you know, bright apple or pear or something like this, amber wines are going to be living in the space of dried fruits and tea. Mm-hmm. So the wine that you're going to smell on this particularly is, you're getting a lot of sort of dried apricot, and you're getting some orange peel. You're getting some, again, black tea notes as well. And then the most distinct thing when you taste is that it's you close your eyes and you're like, is this a white or a red? Because the tannin level, the dryness on this at the finish is as if it were a red wine. And it's a wine that is made to go with meat. And so that's, we're going to try a couple more of those ambers here today and kind of show you the spectrum of them. But this is a great one to get started with because it's, you know, it teaches you what you're looking for, but also it begs the question, you know, what are you eating with it? Because in Georgia, you're never drinking wine without eating.
Right.
So it's an integral part of the meal.
It's very, very interesting. And a lot of what you just said, I think, is absolutely spot on with it. And the tannic structure is actually really striking on this. It's very, very firm. And like you said, I think a great exercise, close your eyes and drink it. And I would almost certainly guess a red, but some of that tea note is very prevalent. As you said, the apricot note is also very, very prevalent. So I was, you know, you kind of go into this because we're informed by our eyes as well. So I expect something that's going to maybe be a little bit more sort of a bright fruit driven, like a tropical fruit or some of the things you would expect from a, you know, any white wine. And it is actually far from that. It's a much deeper, richer wine, and it's actually got a fairly heavy mouthfeel in a very pleasant way.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the way that, you know, Georgians don't do, and the reason why all of that is the case is, and why people, Georgians love this style of wine, and it's the largest produced style of wine, is because when you're eating in Georgia, they take a different approach to pairing. They don't pick each dish and pair it specifically with one different wine. The opposite is what they choose, is that they decide a wine that they want to drink for hours, and then they make it fit to the table. So
it's like,
and then they need to have it. So that wine needs to be both delicious. It needs to be heavier, but not too heavy. So
versatile.
You can drink, you know, a couple of liters by yourself. Exactly. Yeah. Very versatile. So you put this on a table, you still have acidity. You still have these flavors. You know, it's great with vegetables, like roasted vegetables and things like this. So, but then it's also going to be great with fatty pork shoulder cut, you know, or, you know, char grilled or something like this, which is very typical in Georgia. So it goes with everything, and, you know, and the meals are like that. You know, they come out with the antipasto. It's very Italian in that respect, but you're always having the same wine throughout. And the goal is, again, some wines are better for meat, some are not. You know, you try to make the table fit the wine, but you choose the wine first that you want to drink a lot of, and then go from there, as opposed to picking each dish and then trying to fit a wine to that
right.
dish.
Let's do this, Noel. Let's take a little break. What this wine's screaming to me, it's making me think of something like a grilled swordfish with a nice, like, apricot chutney. That's just me.
Yeah.
let's take a break here on the Noel Drink Show. We're going to come back and talk a lot more about Georgian wines with Noel Brogan. Come on back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week, as always. Super interesting stuff here today. Super exciting stuff here today. We are talking about wines from the country of Georgia with Noel Brockett. And I wanted to mention too, just really quickly, Noel, we'll make sure for listeners out there, because we are talking about, you know, the language for those of us, you know, English speakers, and here it's the pronunciation's a little tricky and the spelling's a little tricky, things like that. So we will, on our website, we will have pictures of all the bottles so you can see that. We're going to have a cool wine region map of Georgia posted there so you can kind of see where we're talking about and correlate a lot of this information. So don't fear if you're going, how do you spell that again? If you're trying to write this down, it'll all be there. I couldn't spell it. And I'm glad, Noel, you said there's not going to be a test. So I really do appreciate it.
No test.
Well, so Noel, since we're talking about amber wines, and we were just talking during the break here a second ago, which I think is really astute, you know, I likened it to orange wines, and really they're very, very different. The process is somewhat similar, where we're talking about the skin contact with white grapes, but you know, people like to be able to talk about something they're familiar with. We have another amber wine that we're tasting right now, the Vinoterra Kissi. Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
Yeah. So Kissi is like, again, it's nice because it's easier to say, and you know, not all Georgian varieties are like that. But Kissi is a real success story in Georgia. Like I talked about, there's a lot of varieties. There's a lot of them were lost due to Soviet rule. And Kissi was one that was really the favorite of one of the people I consider to be one of the best winemakers in Georgia. His name is Goki Takashvili. And so he had his own home plant that his great-great-grandfather planted in the early 1900s of Kissi. And it's a variety that is, in my opinion, great for the style of amber or skin contact wine, because it's got all of these really amazing sort of peachy, piney notes and sort of dried peach and intense peach that come out when it's made in a skin contact style, as opposed to when it's made in a European style. And so, you know, Goki was, you know, he loved this grape. He made it. He made it. So this is the Vinoterra. He helped start that winery in the early 2000s when nobody thought you could bottle natural, you know, Cuvée wine and sell it. He said, watch me. And he helped really popularize this variety. And it's what I say, it's a success story, is that, you know, there used to be, I think, a tiny amount planted, you know, in the 10 decahectares, whatever, you know, the unit you want to use. The long and short is that it's grown by almost 100% in the last, and we're going to see a lot more growth of it. So you start to see a lot more people showing it. And the reason why I like it is that it's a wine that, like I said, with that very unique aromatics that's going on, there's, and this particular wine, there's a little bit of smokiness that's really coming through as well. Mm-hmm. That kind of comes through on the mid palate. But Kissi has this really great balance of very aromatic, very structured. And so it does well with exposure to oxygen, which means because of the tannin and its varietal characteristics, it's great for aging. It's a, you know, what I like to treat the Kissis like is like red wines. You know, they're great to try 5-10 years after. Of course, there's not much, but it shows a lot of what the potential is there. So you're going to get those, like I said, great aromatics. And then on this particular wine, which is 2017, it's a year older than the previous one that we had, you know, the tannins are a little bit more managed, you know, than mm-hmm. the first one. So it could be interesting to see, but it's a little bit more delicate there in the finish, but still, you know, that's a relative term for me who drinks a lot of amber wine. So it's probably still quite tannic for most average drinkers.
One of the things you said, which I want to highlight here in this one, that the acid structure in a very positive way is far more bracing in this one. So this one to me can kind of push more, if we're talking about what to pair it with, can kind of push more towards maybe how a white wine would perform. I could see this going really, really well with lots of preparations of shellfish, for example, because of that acid structure being as it is. I was getting, when I first opened it, and I told you I cheated before we started the show, I tasted this one first. And on the nose, I was getting a lot of a dried apricot note, but that's actually kind of changed. And there's more of a peach, and there's really more of kind of a muted floral note, which is also very pleasant.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a great thing to bring out about the structure of acid, is that what I think is pretty masterful about this winemaker and all the wines that he makes, and is that he keeps his brightness there, you know, mm-hmm. right? Which is difficult to do because this is such an oxidative, open air, you know, no additive at all process, you know, so other than adding tiny amounts of sulfites, I mean, it's very difficult to you know, maintain that structure necessarily. And with this such a handoff, but it just goes to his credit that you know, he's bringing this bright wine, and it's all partly the variety, but it's partly, you know, his hands. So.
Yeah. And you mentioned this, and I want to make sure that we highlight this too, because we really are, we're talking about natural wines here, and which I think is a really cool thing. And we mentioned this in the first segment, Quevri, which maybe people would equate with the term amphora, a clay pot, but it's very Georgian in origin. And just, we have about 4 minutes before we're going to take a break, Noel, but let's talk about what a Quevri is and how it's, you know, an ancient practice or used in ancient practice, but it's also really symbolic of contemporary modern winemaking these days in Georgia.
Yeah. So, Quevri, comes from the word kremot, which means below. And that's because these are large. Again, they can vary in size, but in the region that we're drinking in right now, the typical size is somewhere between 1,500 to 2,500 liters. So that's the size of about 4 or 5 barrels. So these are really large egg-shaped clay jars that are buried, kremot, under the ground. And they are made all entirely by hand by master quevri makers. And from special clays that come from distinct regions in Georgia. And obviously, you know, it was the life, it was how you made wine 8,000 years ago, all the way up is, you know, when you didn't have, glass or oak barrels, you know, you had these earthenware, vessels. And, it's really an amazing, unique technology that was discovered, like I said, 8,000 years ago and really perfected, but it's so strange to us. You know, all they do is they pick exactly the right materials, they handcraft it in the exact right way, and then they fire it, you know, up to a, you know, for a whole month in this kiln. So they build them and then they build the kiln around it and they fire it for, you know, and they don't measure the temperature. They just know it, you know, and they see it by the color of the clay and then it comes out. So, you know, a lot of times when I do tastings and I talk about clay jars and, you know, we do the amber wines and a lot of people say, well, I can taste the clay on this. And I say, well, no, you can't. Because, you know, if you can, when we have a serious problem, because, you know, they're fired to food grade, you know, they're fired to food grade. So they are a porous material, but they're shaped in, as, like I said, as eggs buried underneath the ground. And that's, again, that the shape changed over the 8 millennia in Georgia, but it settled on this shape pretty early on because it's a very strong shape. You're burying it in the ground. The only problem that you're going to have is earthquakes. And once you bury it, you use it forever. And but it's very labor intensive. You have to get inside it. You have to clean it with special, especially if you're doing natural wine, you got to do it with, you know, non-chemical ways of doing it. And so very labor intensive, very small production. But again, it's a unique, small kind of batch technology that you can do that creates its own natural convection. It does its own natural filtration. You know, it's one of those amazing things that our ancestors, we have no idea how they built the pyramids, right? Or right. We have no idea how they discovered right. It, but we know it works, right? And we just keep doing it. And that's definitely how it is in Georgia. So it's the lifeblood of Georgia. It's right now, this week, most Georgian winemakers are opening up their quevries after having let them sit for many months. They haven't tasted the wine inside. They just have prayed and hoped that it was going to be great. And they're opening them now as it is Orthodox Easter on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be drinking and feasting, again, socially isolated. But they're going to be drinking and feasting large, large quevries. And that's, you know, that tradition has been around for a couple thousand years in Georgia. And it's still there too today. And quevri is the center of the family about that. You know, it's what it means to have a full, alive home is to have quevries full of wine, and hopefully it's good.
Hopefully it's good. That's really cool. And you find out when you open it up on Easter, on Orthodox Easter. That's really interesting. Yeah, it's like, and you got a lot on the line, huh? If you got the family and the neighborhood over, you got a lot on the line. Well, let's do this, Noel. Let's take a little break here, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to talk a little bit more about winemaking in Georgia in contemporary days. We're going to taste an interesting red. Noel, of course, is going to stick around for another Shot with Noel Drinks, our podcast-only segment, and we're going to get further into the weeds there, as it were, as well. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Noel Drinks Show. Come on back.
A great big glass of wine.
We let the bong gong rule. We let the mule pull. Now don't you be no bully. We let the bong gong rule.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here. Thanks for listening in. We are chatting with Noel Brockett from Georgian Wine House, and they're located in Maryland. I didn't say that before, but a very fine wine importer in that part of the world. And we're talking about, you know, the cultural aspects of how it's so ingrained in the culture of Georgia. Families still make wine today. Table wine is still produced in that sense where you would think in the old world as well. And we were talking about amber wines pretty extensively, which are, of course, made from white grapes with a lot of skin contact, but it's not all white or amber wines there, is it, Noel? We also have some really interesting red wines, and we have one in our glass too, called the Dulao. Yeah.
Yeah, no. So yeah, we've got the Dulao Saporavi, which we're trying. You know, Saporavi is ubiquitous, or what it means for red wine in Georgia is Saporavi. It's a really interesting variety. So the word Saperavi comes from the word peri, which peri means color, and Saperavi means the place of color. And that's because this wine is it's dark red, and because there's actually the flesh of the grape is actually has pigment inside of it. Most people don't realize that red wine is only red because it's been aged on the skins where the pigment leaks. But in this case, it's actually very difficult to make a Saperavi rosé. You have to have modern technology to do it, really, because the flesh is actually red. And that's, you know, there are many table grapes that are like that, but there are only about 13 vinifera grapes or a handful of vinifera grapes that are actually like this. So it's a really rare. That makes it one of the highest in resveratrol, which is the, you know, the good thing for your heart.
The antioxidant stuff, sure.
Yeah, so it's literally been tested as the highest that we know so far in terms of vinifera grapes. It's a fun fact, but the main thing about Saporavi is that it's Georgia's Noblet. I mean, I think most people who are going to experience Georgian wine for the first time, you know, Saporavi is a great way to start. The Dulao is a great way to do it as well, because it's a red wine that kind of shows you what Saporavi is all about, but it's, you know, it's not so strange and different as maybe amber wines are for the average, you know, wine drinker. So, you know, when you talk about Saporavi, you know, Georgia is emphatically a white wine culture. About 70% of production is white wine, again, made in white and amber, European and amber styles. And 30% is red. And of that 30%, probably 20% of that is Saporavi. And it's grown primarily in Kakheti. And it's my opinion, but it's not only my opinion. There's masters of wines and other people who really consider Saporavi sort of on par with the sort of noble grapes of France. And the reason why we think of that is that it has very important characteristics. You know, noble grapes, as we call about them, is that they have very distinct profiles themselves. So, for example, when you talk about Saporavi, no matter what you're talking about Saporavi, you have to think dark, brambly, black fruits. I mean, that is what you're going to get on the nose. That's what you're going to get on the front palate. But what elevates a grape to something more is that those, you know, that distinct characteristic is then going to change based on the terroir, based on the place you grow it. But it's also going to change based on the winemaker, his choices, how you're going to do it. And it's also really ageable, right? So Saporavi ticks a lot, all of those boxes. So the Dulao, why it's a great wine for me is that it's fresh, it's fun, it's got this lovely sour cherry, blackberry, you know, kind of pomegranate thing going on the nose. Mm-hmm. And then when you get it on the palate, it's medium to full body, so it's not super heavy. And the tannin, again, is a little bit more managed, but nice, you know, nicely structured, great. So you can, you know, for the average red wine drinker who likes, you know, it's something you could have easily by the glass, but it's great, you know, intended in general with food. So it's got a lot of versatility in terms of it's a higher acid grape as well, in general. So with the acid and the tannin, you can do a lot with it.
It's really, is this a cooler climate situation too? I mean, like a lot of the country where that's where the acid structure is coming from, I'm assuming.
Yeah, exactly. So Georgia, so Kakheti, which is the eastern part of Georgia, has this really amazing, you know, Georgia, we didn't talk about this so much, is that it's the size of West Virginia. It's about 60,000 square kilometers. So it's the size of a small American state. And it has the climate diversity of, you know, the different climate zones, all of the different climate zones that we have in the United States. It has that existent in this tiny little country. And that's because of mountains, you know. And so the Kakheti region, it's a river valley that's sandwiched between a V of two mountain ranges that converge. And so you have a lot of alluvial soils that's, you know, things that are running down from mountains. And it's a very continental climate. So you're never really seeing over 14% alcohol. Mm-hmm. But that being said, you know, we're all part of global warming here as well. And interesting story that just came out is that, you know, the Italians are in Barolo, Nebbiolo, they're in Tuscany. They're experimenting with planting Saporavi because, you know, the birthplace of wine is also probably the future of wine when it comes to global warming, because there's so much genetic diversity that exists in Georgia. So Saporavi is very tolerant of many things. So you can go, you know, as you get to the farthest eastern part of that region, you know, it's actually semi-desert, and you do get higher alcohols over there. So, but this particular one, you're exactly right. It's a cooler, more continental climate, you know, really cool nights, warm days. Mm-hmm. And you can, things ripen up really slowly and nicely so far.
Yeah, it's delicious. I mean, and as you mentioned, I mean, this to me, and I don't mean this in sort of a trite way, this performs like a red wine should. In a sense, it's got a nice, there's a nice fruit structure. The acid backbone is there to be very, very pleasant. The tannins are quite firm in this in a very pleasant way. So, I mean, you could easily go in a red meat direction with it without a problem with this, but there's a balance, a nice balance between the fruit. Does this one see any wood, Noel, at all? Or a touch?
It doesn't. Yeah. So that's what's interesting. So the way that this wine works is that it spends 1 month in the cuvée. Okay. And so we just do fermentation. And once fermentation and malolactic fermentation has finished, they rack this wine into stainless steel. So it's a little bit of a hybrid, and that's simply because of space. We wanted to have a wine that this comes in, you know, on the shelf around $16-$17, and that's very difficult to do with such a laborious style of winemaking. But it was important for us to be able to offer value and great wine, you know, to the consumer to kind of get them interested in the more stuff. So they make a higher end wine, this winery, that's really fantastic. It goes under the label Orgo. But this was a way to, you know, reuse the cuvées twice. It's a lot more cleaning, but at the same time, okay, it's an interesting sort of hybrid style of ancient and modern.
So clearly, I mean, it's a very, obviously a robust grape then, because if I had blind tasted this without talking to you, I would have thought that this sat on some neutral or even maybe, you know, 5 or 10% new consideration for a short period of time, because there's a smokiness to it that I would have attributed to wood as opposed to the grape itself, which is fascinating, and the quivery, which is really interesting. Well, let's do this now.
And that's the secondary. Okay.
Go ahead. Yeah, sorry. Real quick. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just going to say there's that secondary note of Saporavi, which it, sometimes it can be earthy, sometimes it can be chocolate, and sometimes it can be smoke. And that, again, exactly, it's depending on where it's grown and how it's made. That's the kind of third note that's happening in the mid-palate on Saporavi, and you see it change based on, you know, who's making it and where it's grown.
And where it's grown. Cool. Well, we got about a minute and a half left before we have to close out the radio portion of the show. You're sticking around for another Shot with Noel Drink, so we're going to get further into this, taste another red, another amber. So, friends, if you're listening on the radio, go get the podcast. But, Noel, quickly tell people where they can connect with Georgian Wine House and also Wines of Georgia.
Yeah, so Wines of Georgia is the marketing, is the, you know, the PR place of us, of the Georgian Wine Government.
The association,
wines georgia.com.
Sure.
Okay. Uh-huh. Exactly, the association. Yeah, so it's winesgeorgia.com. That's a great resource. Georgian Wine House, you can connect directly to us at georgianwinehouse.com. You can find us on Facebook under, we also manage the Wines of Georgia on Facebook, and as well on Instagram at Georgian Wine House DC. So definitely we're going to be pumping out some stuff on those categories as we're all spending more time at home, and ways to explore more. And then obviously there are shops, around, the New Orleans area where you can, that we're tasting, as well. So that's, you know, a great way to get connected with us.
Awesome. Well, cool. You're going to stick around for another Shot with Noel Drinks, friends. I do encourage you, go get the podcast. You can get it on noeldrinks.com, where you can connect with the show on your favorite podcast network. We're in pretty much all of them, most of them these days. And yeah, so there you go. Right now, friends, remember to be kind to one another more than ever. Always use your turn signal. And until next time, cheers, y'all.
inside. What are you doing in a place like this? I said I called your name, but no one came. Now I see you become just like the company you keep. And he said, all these saints and all these sinners will try to bend your.
All right, everybody, up another shot with Noah Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. I do appreciate it. I hope you are enjoying our conversation with Noel. Very fascinating stuff. And we're about to bounce back over to our conversation with him. We're going to talk a little bit more about his background and his deep connection to the country of Georgia, taste a couple more wines, talk a little bit more about terroir, a little bit more about the history. All very, very fascinating stuff. Here we go. All right, everybody, up another shot with Noel Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. We're chatting with Noel Brockett, who is an expert on Georgian wines. And we had an interesting conversation in the first three segments of the show, and now we're here in our podcast only segment. And I wanted to actually ask you this because we talked about your role with Georgian Wine House, but you married a local girl and you speak the language and you've really involved yourself in the Georgian culture considerably, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I have no business selling Georgian wine if it wasn't for some crisp nights in September and October of 2007, where I met a young woman at college, I met my wife in Annapolis, Maryland. She came to a tiny, small liberal arts college that most Americans have never heard of, but somehow in Georgia. She was applying to Ivy League schools and as a valedictorian, and somebody caught her in mind and said, well, you probably do really great at Yale, but this other college seems really great for you. And she somehow believed him and was right, I think, for her. And so
I
met her, you know. Right. Yeah, for me, I'm thankful. I met her, you know, I was studying what's called Great Books, which is it's a program where we basically read old books and they're by authors who wrote them themselves as opposed to digested through textbooks. And we talk about them and think about sort of large questions. And it's a very leisurely activity, though very difficult and rigorous. And I met her and she was, you know, obviously exotic and amazing and interesting and intelligent person. And she was telling me about this amazing place called Georgia, and it's the birthplace of wine. And, you know, it's ancient civilization. It's, you know, you're reading Herodotus and here's the Georgians that are mixed in. It's this ancient culture. And I said, you're lying. And she said, and then I went home and I Googled it like any good American and realized, of course, that I was wrong and she was right. And I didn't know anything. I thought Georgia was a state. And here was, you know, a good ignorant American. So, yeah, and I'm, you know, by the summer of 2008, I was in Georgia. I had started a nonprofit that was working in Georgia with my wife and some other students. And, you know, I spent 3 years working, you know, most of the summers over there working on promoting liberal arts and getting a great education on terms of wine. And, you know, I was a young 20-year-old, and that's the thing about in America, you know, we don't, most people at that age and that income level don't necessarily have access to wine or access to good wine. Mm-hmm. And going to Georgia, where I was this sort of person of honor, where I'm there at the everywhere you're going is a feast. And every time you go there, you know, you're the one who's supposed to pick the wine that we're going to drink for everybody. And, you know, it was a great way to taste through 6 or 7 wines and be like, oh, I like this wine the best. And they're like, oh, how did you know? So, well, it's because this one's too sweet and this one is this, blah, blah, blah. You learn so much about wine making and wine by tasting. And of course, I was really enthralled by the way that people consumed the wine. And that felt really amazing to me that it was a thing that wasn't locked up in wine, you know, wine shops, but rather it was, a thing that you did communally together. And then, you know, I came back and I didn't, I wanted to work in Georgia, but I didn't want to work in the, for the State Department because I liked my freedom. There's no guarantee in the State Department, unfortunately, getting to do what you want to do. And so I was working, you know, in the industry. I had given up a good job as a software kind of engineering thing that just didn't love. And luckily I was working for a restaurant and I told the guys, like, have you ever tried Georgian wine? And there's a nice guy going through a midlife crisis who bought a restaurant. So I had no business being in the restaurant industry. And he said, sure, you know, well, I've never tried it. This is an Italian restaurant, but if you want to sell Georgian wine, go for it. And I said, great. You know,
wow, okay.
So I got in contact with the Georgian wine house and you know, I said, hey, I've got a place to sell. And that started that relationship. And then, like anything in the industry, you sort of rolled into it and had the opportunity to kind of take the reins for the company and see where I could steer it. And, you know, the rest is history. So that's, I still, you know, have it all due back to my wife and the family that I have over in Georgia, who are great supports and encouragers and educators every day on what it is that I'm trying to do.
That's great. I I'll spare listeners, probably some listeners will know this already, but I think you made a great choice. I have a lot of friends that I went to graduate school with that were in the Foreign Service. I think that's where you were going. And I'm glad I didn't do it either.
Yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you drinking wine.
Exactly. Doing good work, but it isn't for me.
Yeah, I hear you, man. Right on. I'm right with you. Well, let me ask you this. Let me backtrack. Let's talk, because we're tasting the third amber, and I want to talk about that. And then I want to talk about another aspect of the history that we didn't really get to in the first segment with you. But how about, we're drinking another amber. It's a Mitsvane. This is by Chona. It's a beautiful wine, man. This is kind of, and I see why we went in that order. This one goes up the scale. And at first, when you take the first, it hits you right out of the gate in the front palate, almost like a Sauternes. But then the finish is radically different than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just taking a sip there. I mean, it's what I love about Chona's and basically sort of the natural wine, low intervention group that we heavily, you know, that are, has its lifeblood and birthplace, I think, in Georgia and probably its greatest defendants, is that, you know, I mean, this wine is very much alive to me, you know, so it's got this really great, amazing mix of sweetness. Like you said, you get this sort of maybe even a little botrytis-sized kind of things, but I don't think there's botrytis on there. You know, it's just these lovely, rich, intense aromatic flavors that you get from this particular grape, which is the Cajetien Mitsvane, which again means the green grape from Mitsvane. And this is typically 90%. It's co-planted and co-fermented with Roccatatelli most of the time in Cajetien because they make a great marriage. But this is 100% Mitsvane, and it was the first year that he was able to make that. And he, why I think his wines are really interesting aromatically and also on the palate, is because of the where they're grown, you know. So he is in this very, a cooler general place, a really famous place for white grapes, Roccatatelli Mitsvane in particular. It's called Sinandali, and it's lower in the valley in the central part of Cajetien. And so he grows majority of Roccatatelli. So he makes a Roccatatelli, he makes a Roccatatelli and Mitsvane blend, and he makes a 100% Mitsvane. And, I really think Mitsvane has a lot of potential. It's just a very, we've seen a lot more come on the market since 2015, 2016, but it's a finicky grape. It can be quite sensitive to oxygen, and so to get the balance that he has here of this lovely touch of sweetness, you know, but maybe a touch of VA on there. I love VA personally.
Yeah,
well,
a nice kiss of it. Yeah, it's only when it's a preponderance that it's a problem.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's like, you know, and that, because it's so important to have that sort of like that acidic structure that you talked about, that's a little bit racier, a little bit edgier than maybe the wines that we had previously. And then this one is a very, very tannic grape, you know, so it can sometimes be super, super dusty and really aggressive. But it's also got these sort of meaty kind of like cured meat thing going in the middle palate as well. So it's this really kind of fun roller coaster of multiple layers as a grape. And, you know, this is a thing that he makes tiny amounts of wine. You know, he makes a couple, Cuvée, or I think this one is one Cuvée in 2018. And this is like 2,500 bottles. And, You know, it's all lovingly done by hand, and you can go on and check him out on Facebook, and you can see that he's just the last 4 or 5 days he's been opening his Cleveries with the 2020 vintage and tasting them and seeing. And what he'll do then is he'll rack them into stainless steel and do settling. And so he just, you know, very low intervention, though he is trying to think about how to manage tannin that way, hence why he's letting it settle and age on the lees, but no stir up, and trying to get that creaminess in the middle palate, but not super. And then he's, you know, just tiny amounts of sulfites. I mean, it's all of the three of the ambers that we have, they're all sitting about 50 parts per million, okay. Which is, you know,
yeah.
Tiny. You know, they try to do, which is 50 parts per million total, which is, they're all adding about just 10 parts. Added is only about 10 parts per million just to stop malolactic fermentation, you know, so sure. It's just enough. So it's, but again, there's three lovely sort of iterations on that spectrum, and they can get even funkier than this, and they can get even cleaner, you know, than all of them. But it's, you know, it's a whole spectrum of things that you can do with the style.
It's fascinating. And I want to move on to a couple of things, but when you first taste it, the thickness of the mouthfeel is a fairly viscous wine right out of the gate. And that's why I said, yeah. Your palate, I guess, maybe because I'm conditioned, I was expecting, you know, I started to get that front palate Sauternes, as I mentioned, kind of thing. But then all of a sudden it's like, boom, tannins, and then boom, acid at the end. And so, yeah. I mean, it really, it's odd in a sense. It's almost inverse in what you would expect. It actually is thicker, and the fruit is, you know, really the sweetness, the sort of perceived sweetness is really up front, and then it finishes very dry and very tannic, and it's a really gorgeous, it's a really nice wine, man. I really like it a lot.
Yeah he is somebody to be watching, you know. And that's really made that wine made it to New Orleans just kind of on a bet, you know. Our distributor Matt Lorette, he just was like, what do you got in that's great, you know, before all this stuff started happening. And I was like, you should be paying attention to Jonas, you know. And he's just bought it blind, and because it's something that I think exactly right, that, you know, anybody who's either tried an amber wine before or maybe even hasn't, you know, there's just a lot to get behind. You can see that it's a thoughtful made wine, and,
yeah.
And that has a lot of soul, which is what George is all about.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we brought it back to Georgia here, just sort of in a broad sense, what we didn't touch on this in the history, because obviously Georgia has had, I'll use the term relationship, not necessarily always a good one, with its large neighbor to the north being the former Soviet Union and now Russia. But the influence that the former Soviet Union and Russia before and now play, it's had a significant effect on the wine industry, you know, for a long period of time. Can you kind of sort of explain that, and even how it's affected what was planted, and then now even how it relates to people rediscovering the 500 plus species of vinifera that are found there?
Yeah.
I know, very broad, you know, again, question. I just wanted to hear you talk so I can drink
while. Georgians can talk about Russia for forever. No, it's what I would just say, that, again, historical context is really important here, is that, you know, when we talk about Russia being influential in Georgia, it's the same kind of thing as America. You know, Russia as a world power has come onto the scene in the last couple hundred years, you know. So again, in terms of Georgian perspective, it's quite a blip in the history, but it's something that's really been affecting us and them. So like just to be said, that there's really no influence in Georgia of Russia until the 18th century.
Yeah, so they're the punk ass new kid on the block, right? Is kind of what we're saying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Right? No, I mean, Georgia was—they were dealing with a lot of other people, you know, before that. You know, that they're dealing with the Mongols, and then the Persians, and then the Turks, and you know, all sorts of people in between. And then the Russians showed up as people to help out, you know, and that was that's where the complicated relationship with Russia always was, is that there was some sort of affinity there as Christian countries. And Georgia ends up getting annexed as a way in the, you know, in about 200 years ago to help protect from sort of the invasions that are happening through the Turks at that time. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, that changed a whole lot of people, you know, countries that we know of now, you know, changed drastically because of that. And so they helped stave off that. But so there's this kind of complicated, a very friendly relationship in terms of people, you know, there's a lot of affinity towards culture. But at the same time, the political structures that came to dominate in Russia and then the Soviet Union were things that were, you know, not a lot in line with Georgia, obviously. So, so what happened is, you know, the Russians come over and they're, as when they're still an imperial state, they start taking over and they start, they want to use, as any good empire wants to use, the lands that they're, think that they own for their own purposes. So they already had started sort of building up wine industries in Georgia in the 1800s, which is fine with Georgians because they liked wine. But when it came to the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union came, you know, the Soviet Union was a whole other idea of economy. And it was about how do we produce certain products so that every single person in the entire Soviet Union, which is a very disparate, you know, country, have the same exact things. And so Georgia and Moldova and a couple others were spotted as this is how we're going to produce cheap wine for every single person so that it's wine is easily accessible, you know, for almost no money. And so that was hard to do with a place that's, like I said, the size of West Virginia. So they immediately start moving into industrial size wine production, which is the same thing that happens in the U.S. And so, you know, originally that was actually in Quevery. Ironically, they bought, made mass-produced Quevery, produced these wines. This is like I'm talking about the early 1920s, 1930s. And then modern, semi-modern technologies, you know, came in the 1940s and 1950s. And that really, then they ripped those all up and really started ripping up ancient varieties. And planting them. So the really important thing for people to understand is that there is no private property in the communist regime. So all of the fields that were planted, you know, prior to that and all the vines that were planted, they were now owned by the state. Only your immediate sort of 0.8, you know, hectares that was around your house, if you had as much, that was your own private property. Mm-hmm. And so what Georgians do when they're being conquered is that they take their precious vines and they take their precious treasures and things like this and they go and hide them. They have a huge tradition of doing that. And so what they did is that before those things got all chopped down, most of them were people brought in, planted in their yards, but they only planted 1, 2, 3, you know, kind of vines as much as they could fit. And so we do know that hundreds of varieties were lost definitely during the Soviet Union. We know in at least in the last 100 years, at least 100, if not more, were lost. But what we're starting to see is that people are now going back and discovering after the Soviet Union fell, you know, that people have these varieties that were planted in their yard. And so there's actually this museum, this nursery in Georgia that houses, their goal is to get all 525 that are known. And they have over 400 that are each planted side by side. So you can go see, and this for Georgia is like, you know, wow, intangible history. So, mm-hmm. There's now multiple places that have the majority of those things over in case, you know, something would happen. And you know, like I said, the U.S. people from Italy, all these people are now coming to Georgia and saying, hey, can we get cuttings of a wide swath of these varieties so that we can go and test them and see what the genetic material is like? Maybe we can hybrid with other things to make them more resistant. Because as the birthplace of wine, those, you know, the genetic material of the vines from this region is the most diverse. Mm-hmm. So there may be hidden traits in a lot of these grapevines that are going to save, you know, grapevines in winemaking regions that are going to become too hot too soon for growing grapes. So, you know, that, and then long story, the last thing to say is that, you know, Russia obviously is no longer the Soviet Union. It's quite despotic still. You know, they constantly use, being the largest importer of Georgian wine still, they use that to their advantage all the time to try to use it as leverage. So in 2000, this company was actually started because Russia levied an embargo to try to cripple the Georgian wine industry, mm-hmm. in 2005, when they elected a pro-Western government. And, you know, that, at that point, there were 90% of Georgian exports were going to Russia. So it did cripple the industry, but it gave us an opportunity to say, well, we need to find other markets, you know, and the U.S. is one of the most strategic markets for Georgia. And before the outbreak of coronavirus, it was the largest amount of, there's a tiny country, but they were investing their most amount of money to try to grow sales in the United States. And they had a strategic plan for that, and they still do. So it's, they really understand that. And the way that I look at wine too is that, you know, it's not just about any producer or any wine. It's about making the connections that are human connections, so that, you know, the next time that Georgia is being invaded by Russia, which we were in 2008, you know, the world pays a little bit more attention because maybe they've had a good Saporavi or a good Riccatelli, and they realize these are, you know, interesting people, and they've heard a story, and we should pay attention to this. Because when you're living without security, you know, it's a hard road, and it's nice to have friends.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you touched on something we've talked about on the show before, which I think, and you've said it very well, so I don't need to elaborate on it, that understanding the importance of foodways, of which wine is certainly a part, it brings, there's a cultural aspect, there's an educational aspect. It's not just what tastes good. And it's such an, it's an ambassador for so many things, how we eat and how we drink. And that's a, this is just what you just said is a fantastic example of that. So I appreciate you saying that. Let me ask you this really quickly too. So, let's talk about the red that we have in our glass, and then I want to talk a little bit about the U.S. market before we have to close things out, that you've been sort of experiencing, and what you guys have been kind of carving a niche out at Georgian Winehouse for the wines. But let me backtrack. So tell us about this red that we're drinking, the Chona.
Yeah, so this is the Chona Saporavi. This is the first vintage that he has bottled, brought out, which is great. It's also from, so he organically farms his hectare, you know, his 3 hectares that he has, and the majority are in Sinandali, but he has a vineyard in the, again, of Saporavi, in a very specific sort of famous and well-known place for Saporavi, which is a appellation called Mukuzani. And so the what you see on this, it's more of what I would say, as opposed to the Dilao, which is trying to be a little bit lighter, a little bit fresher. This is more of your sort of serious and austere kind of Saporavi that you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to get those fruits, but they're not as, not necessarily as fresh, right? And so you're getting more of those sort of secondary notes, a lot of earthiness on the wine. A bunch more tannin, you know, then you get a lot firmer than what you're going to get on the deal. It's kind of in your face. You know, Saporavi in general, I think, does well with quite a bit of age. But most Georgians like to drink them young and robust, you know, think Northern mm-hmm. Italy or something like that. Mm-hmm. So this is definitely a wine that I go with food, but it's, just so much going on, so deep with that as well. So again, you still feel the acid structure is strong with Saporavi. Again, it's a very acidic grape. You know, even through Mallow, you're going to get a lot going on. And he's, again, in the continental, the central part as well. So it's not super hot in where he is. But that being said, it was a hotter year in 2018, which is what we're drinking. So in general, it was hotter for everywhere in the country. So this is at 14.5% alcohol. So, but you wouldn't, really, you don't really feel the heat on the nose. So it's an interesting mm-hmm. kind of different vintage than normal.
It is. It's very interesting because I would have never guessed that it was 14.5 by tasting it. And I get also what you say, Noel, about how I get why people would want to drink it young to a degree, because had I blinded this, I would have guessed at least a couple years older than 18, just because the fruit structure, you don't get that bright red candied kind of fruit note. It's more very dark fruit, a lot of pepper on this too. And the tannins are also, you know, it's a very firm tannin structure on this wine. So I would have guessed like, you know, 16, 15, but I can also get why you say that I can see this wine aging, you know, very well. And it would be a very subtle and restrained wine, I'm going to guess, after 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is to be, most of us have not tried a lot of 10-year-old Saporavi, and that's the fun part about being in this is that, you know, a lot of people have such small production that they need to sell, you know, that, and they have clients to sell, you know, when you're selling like he is, you know, that 2018 was his largest year in his history where he sold, I think, 8,000 bottles, and in 2019 he has, you know, he's up to 11,000 bottles, you know, because they used to be selling the grapes, you know, and so, you know, and that's the thing, it's tiny amounts of wine, and especially when we talk about the U.S. market. And that's what's so great about Georgia is that you can have a wine like this, you know, you're dropping, you know, less than $30 on it, you know, around there, you know, so it's not an everyday cause, but again, it's not an everyday wine because there's only such a little production, but that goes back and has a direct economic impact with to a family with a face so that you can go and see you that would be happy to host you and love you, you know, mm-hmm. It's just a warmth and amazing kind of economic impact that you can have by just, you know, selling through 60 bottles of wine, you know, at your local wine shop, which is nothing, you know, for so many people, and it's everything for Georgia. So it's fun to have wines like that, that you could be one of the few to ever age at, you know, 10 years old, and have that unique experience and share that with people.
Absolutely. And as you guys, you know, continue your journey, just make sure that you keep me on the invite list, man, because I want to taste some of that stuff. Well, and
my list is always big.
Thanks. We do see, and we won't be too elaborate in this, but the market here in the United States is growing, and we have a lot of listeners outside the United States, so I don't want to focus too much on that, but it is growing, and it is kind of a bellwether in a lot of ways. As we said, we see these wines priced very friendly. So, you know, if you're in the industry and you're looking for some interesting stuff that you can, you know, put on the BTG list, if you know how to sell wine on the floor, I think a lot of these fit terrifically. And I think everything that, you know, and they're so food friendly. And if you're in a sort of a chef wine driven place, there's a lot of really cool ways these wines can go with a lot of different food.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we obviously work a ton with restaurants, and that's primarily where we've done a lot with, especially these fun different wines, and yeah, geeked out with many a chef together about how to pair these wines, and mm-hmm. done a lot of meals and lots of things, and it never, you know, it never ceases to amaze me, you know, what we can do, because there's just so much versatility, and you know, and like I said, this is just five wines of thousands, you know, that are really are interesting and are worth checking out. So there's more, so much more to discover in Georgia than, yeah, we're just scratching the surface. So it's a fun place to be at.
Noel, do me a favor, because then this lets us leave it at a good place right here. So make me this promise, man, because there's about 100 more things that I would like to ask you. Obviously, there's more than 100 wines that I'd like to taste to get to. So would you come back on the show sometime in the near future? We'll taste some other stuff and take the conversation in a couple other directions.
Let's do it, man. I'm always more now than ever. Yeah, you know, that was always when they started the businesses that we said, we have no idea how many people are going to buy Georgian wine, but we're going to bring the wines that if we can't sell them, we want to drink them. So now is the time. So let's get together and try a bunch of different wines and happily come back. And there's, like I said, so much more to discover, and not every day I'm learning more. So it'd be a great time to get together and do more.
Awesome. Great. Noel, do me a favor. Tell people one more time how they can connect with you guys and connect with Wines Georgia as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And industry people, if there's more of you out there, I mean, georgianwinehouse.com, info@georgianwinehouse.com. I mean, it all goes to the few of us, so it's a great way to get directly at us. That's email and our website. WinesGeorgia.com, again, a great resource for all things Georgia and wineries that we don't necessarily represent, but just all many, many other good ones as well. And then check us out, Georgian Wine House, at Georgian Wine House DC. We're, you know, and you can check out there, because we'll be doing some other Zoom stuff and other shows and other things like that that we can, you know, connect in and maybe get some more in-depth stuff. And then also, if you want interested in wines in the area, you know, check out Lorette Selections. These guys are amazing distributors down that area. So if there's, you want to connect, you want to buy them, you know, there's limited stock that's down there. So
that's for our New Orleans friends, yeah. Just so we're clear. So Lorette Selections is a fine boutique distributor here in New Orleans, if you're listening here locally.
That's right. Yeah. And there's many, if you're in other places other than that, like I know that we have a wide audience, you know, you can check out where we're distributed, you know, and of course, if you need to email us exactly, you know, how do we get the wines, you know, feel free to email us. But on our website, there's you know, good access to who carries the lines and in what different areas.
Awesome. Noel, thanks so much, man. I appreciate it. Look forward to having you back on again soon, and be safe and be well, you and yours.
You too, Ryan.
Thank you. Friends, we'll take a brief musical interlude and I'll be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. I do appreciate it as always. Very, very interesting show. I appreciate Noel's time. Very much a pleasure to chat with him. Great guy. I had a lot of great offline, off-air conversations in between segments. And yeah, some really delicious wine. So I want to thank Georgian Winehouse for sharing those with me also. And yeah, this is our parting shot. You know, one of the things, friends, that we talk about on the show and from time to time is, you know, how to improve your tasting skills. And we've gone down this road quite a few times, and many of you out there already know how to do it. But, you know, tasting things side by side, writing notes so you can articulate what it is that you're tasting. Also, remember, I think there's a reinforcement thing that goes when you write tasting notes, try and identify the flavors that you're getting, reading the information put out by the winery, for example, and comparing them to your notes, because then you start to learn the flavors, you start to learn how the terroir affects the wine, you start to learn how the actual production methodology, the choices of the winemaker, so on and so forth, affect the wine. And these are all great ways to improve your tasting skills, putting it in a framework that you can understand, compare, contrast, articulate, et cetera, et cetera. One of the things that I think is also really fascinating, and it struck me, pardon me, with this example of this show, with the deep history of Georgian wines over 8,000 years, as we touched on before, the cradle of winemaking, reading about the history of wines, the provenance, if you will, of the wines that you're tasting, I think is also a great way to improve your tasting skills, because it puts it in an historical context, which I think is very, very valuable. One of the things when we define terroir, and you know, all know the term terroir, that's the environment, that's the dirt, that's the climate, the rain, the sunlight, so on and so forth, the ecological aspect of where in such that you're growing wines. But culture and humanity is also a part of terroir. In no place, obviously, is there a richer example of that than when we talk about Georgian wines. So another way to go about, I think, improving your tasting skills, because it basically enhances your appreciation of wine, it deepens your understanding of what it is that you're drinking. You're connecting to the people, you're connecting to the culture, you're connecting to the history with each glass that you taste. And obviously, like many of the things that we talked about on this particular show, you know, using the Quevri, for example, that's a tradition that goes back millennia. So in some ways, and in many ways, the wines and what you're tasting in the glass are reflective of that tradition. And certainly winemaking has improved, and I'm sure they taste a hell of a lot better than they did 8,000 years ago. But in some ways, those flavor profiles, the effects of the winemaking traditionally, are still present in that glass today. Then also, of course, just the cultural connection to that is still present in the glass today. And that's another way that I think is very, very valuable to enhance your appreciation of wine, really spirits in general, anything that you taste. We talk about food ways on the show. But when you're going out and you're taking some of our advice and advice from others about how to improve your tasting skills, I think adding a historical component into it is a really great way to do things. Certainly, you can find a lot of stuff online, you know, Wikipedia. There's all kinds of great books out there. And in this case, we mentioned winesgeorgia.com is a fantastic resource. So, friends, there's another way to connect and appreciate what it is in your glass and savor each and every sip all the way through. That's our parting shot. Here's to you.